Today on the 21st Show, we're talking about the new category of weight loss medications coming online. So far, there's Wegovy and Ozempic, but more are expected. We'll talk about how they differ from what came before and what they tell us about our understanding of weight and health. We'll talk about all this with two physicians who specialize in weight loss, as well as author Kathy O'Neill, who wrote about the weight loss industry in her book, The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. We'll also take your questions at 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. According to the Trust for America's Health, a nonpartisan public health organization, nearly 40% of Illinois adults and nearly 20% of Illinois children can be diagnosed as obese. The Illinois Department of Public Health says a high-risk waistline for obesity is 35 inches for women and 40 inches for men. But in the past year or so, you may have begun hearing about a pharmaceutical breakthrough, a category of drugs that can, in essence, rewire the brain to change people's relationship to food. It's called semaglutide, and it's sold under the names Ozempic and Wegovy. Earlier this year, NPR talked with 53-year-old Yolanda Hamilton from South Holland, Illinois. She was prescribed Wegovy because she had an elevated BMI, blood pressure, and blood sugar.
I was very surprised about how much weight I lost on Wegovy. And I was very surprised about how good I felt. Gave me more energy to do other things. Exercising, coming home from work and able to do house chores.
But Hamilton's story is not exactly a happily ever after. Wegovy cost $1,400 a month, and her Aetna insurance plan did cover that, but when she changed jobs, her insurance changed to Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois, and that company denied coverage. Like many Americans, Hamilton has a job that requires her to mostly sit in one place. She registers emergency room patients, and months after going off Wegovy, she had already gained back 20 of the 60 pounds she had dropped. Beyond that, some of these medicines are said to be in short supply, in part because of wealthy people using the drug for cosmetic reasons. But if these medicines deliver on their promise and become more widely available, they could be a game changer for the health of millions of Americans. That's what I've heard on a number of other programs, at least. And if that sounds too good to be true, well, maybe it is. At the very least, it's complicated. So we're going to spend our entire hour today talking about weight and healthcare and medicine and the weight loss industry in America, as well as the pressure and shame people are made to feel with all of this. Joining us, Dr. Disha Narang. She's a board-certified internal medicine specialist and endocrinologist, and she's also director of obesity medicine at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital. Dr. Narang, welcome to the 21st Show. And Dr. Narang, you might be muted there on the Zoom call, but welcome to the show. Dr. Nicole Florence, I'll welcome you, board certified in internal medicine, pediatrics, and bariatric medicine. She's also medical director and bariatrician at the Memorial Wellness Center in Springfield. Dr. Florence, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having the conversation.
And also with us, Kathy O'Neill, who is an author and data scientist. She's a PhD mathematician who both worked for a hedge fund and was later part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And on point for our conversation today, she's the author of The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. Kathy, welcome to the 21st Show.
Really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can join this conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. What do you want to know about these weight loss drugs? Do you have an opinion maybe about the affordability or availability of the medicines? Again, give us a call, 800-222-9455, or you can always email us, talk@21stshow.org. So, Dr. Florence, I want to begin with you, and I think I want to start with a sort of simple baseline question. What is obesity? And I don't mean, you know, BMI greater than blah, blah, blah. I mean, what is actually happening in our bodies?
Yeah, so I think the simplest explanation is that we all have a set point. We all have a set point of the energy that we take in and the energy we burn. And if we obviously take in too much energy, we're not burning it, then we store that energy within a fat cell to be used later. And what we're finding is because of genetic predisposition, and yes, because of some lifestyle and habits, that people's set point is different, very individualized to the point where they seem to store more energy than what they burn. That's probably about the simplest explanation I could give.
Okay. And Dr. Narang, what when it comes to weight loss, what works so far? This is something people have been trying to do for many, many years now. What actually works? What does the evidence tell us? And Dr. Narang, are you with us? Maybe I'll redirect that question to you, Dr. Florence, while we try and sort out what's going on with Dr. Narang's microphone there. What is the evidence? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, you know, in the old days, and I'll say that I've been certified in obesity medicine since 2014, and just in the 8 years, we've seen a change. You know, we used to think that it was willpower. We used to think it was mainly calories in and calories out. And what we're seeing is that there's this genetic preset, but there's also all these other hormones, not only in our brain, but in our gut and in our stomach, that really trigger our hunger, our fullness, and how we burn and store energy. So I think science has taught us it's more than just, hey, you shouldn't eat that much and you should exercise more. There's definitely more factors involved.
More factors involved. And yet, Kathy O'Neill, in your book, The Shame Machine, you write about this industry and these billions and billions of dollars that people have spent on everything from Weight Watchers to Seattle Sutton. Can you, and all that is in the context of this weaponization of shame. Can you talk a little bit about how this industry works?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important what the doctor just mentioned. Like, we actually don't know why people are getting fat. It's happening across time, across nations. It's happening to pets. It's even happening to wild animals. It might have more to do with the way agriculture works and fertilizers. We actually have no idea. I mean, I think it's really hard for people to accept and to swallow that we have uncertainty here and that science hasn't explained it. And so I think people who want to, you know, who want to believe that there's a chance for them to be thin, they just don't accept it. It's a kind of, and that's sort of the exact point of the diet industry. I mean, the diet industry, which is a $6 billion industry, I'm actually not sure exactly how many billion dollars per year they make, but they are feeding us like bad science and hope in order for us to pay them to make something happen, which isn't going to happen. And then when we fail to lose weight on like their diets or their Noom or whatever their apps nowadays, then it's our fault and we should be ashamed of ourselves. And so that's the shame machine I mentioned in my book. It's like, it is trying to make individuals solve a systemic problem that they have no chance to solve. And then blaming them or having them blame themselves. And it's kind of an amazing trick. Can you imagine like another industry that makes you pay for things? And then when the product doesn't work, they make, you know, it's your fault and you should buy more of it. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Dr. Florence, do you get people coming to you after having sort of run aground on this industry in America?
Oh my gosh. You know, one of the first things that we do with all of our patients, you know, on top of a complete medical history is we talk about their weight history. You know, how long have they been struggling? What are things that they've tried that have worked, failed? And really what's impressive is the number of trials of different diets, hypnosis, books. It's just astounding. And what I typically find with these patients is they'll say, yeah, I know how to lose maybe 20, 25 pounds, but I always regain it. You know, all of these things are not sustainable and I lose hope. And when you look at their checklist, I'm just astounded of maybe how much time, how much money as she stated, has been put towards something that we knew on the offset was not going to be successful for them.
Yeah. All right. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you want to join our conversation today, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. We are talking about weight and weight loss and these new medicines coming online. Semaglutide is the name of the medicine. They're sold as Ozempic and Wegovy. We're talking about this with Dr. Nicole Florence, who is medical director at the Memorial Wellness Center in Springfield. Also Kathy O'Neill, who's a data scientist and the author of The Shame Machine, Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. And Dr. Disha Narang, who is director of obesity medicine at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital. Dr. Narang, are you with us now?
I am. I apologize for the earlier technical
difficulties. Excellent. No, we're so glad to have you. So I'm glad we got that sorted out. So I want to ask you, so this idea of Ozempic and Wegovy, it may be new to some Americans, but not to people who have been dealing with diabetes for a while. Talk about how long this category of drugs has been around, what it's been used for.
Absolutely. So Wegovy and Ozempic are, like you said, semaglutide. They're in the category of medications called GLP-1 agonists. And I'm an endocrinologist as well. And so for in the diabetes realm, we have been using GLP-1 agonists for well over a decade at this point. And so they've been around initially, you know, they started out as twice a day injections with Byetta. Then we transitioned to daily injections with Victoza, which is liraglutide. And so now we're at the level of weekly injectables. And so, you know, these have been game changers in the world of diabetes and, of course, now weight management. And so we're very used to treating patients with these medications. We're very used to patients doing well on these medications. And now I think within the last year, it's picked up a lot of press because of all of the weight, you know, surrounding it and the weight loss results surrounding it. And you know, it may have been mentioned a little earlier as well, but, you know, we need to treat obesity now and always just as a chronic disease, just like we do diabetes, just like we do blood pressure, just like we do, you know, high cholesterol. And so the publicity that this has picked up, it's not necessarily new to the clinicians that are, you know, treating patients every day, but I think part of it is also, it's not a short-term therapy. This is not like a 3-month quick fix for weight. And that's something that I think needs to be understood, that this is, you know, I just saw a patient literally 20 minutes ago. He's had obesity for 42 years. This is a long haul, you know, disease, right? And so we need to treat it as such as well.
Yeah, and I want to come back to some of those points, but I want to ask who qualifies for this? We asked members of our texting group about this. Teresa said, I'm a borderline diabetes 2 and asked my endocrinologist to prescribe Ozempic, but told me no. So who qualifies to receive this medication?
So
Dr. Narang, I'll ask that to you.
Oh, okay, yes. It's right now indicated for type 2 diabetes only. I will say that some insurances may cover under a prediabetes diagnosis. So I don't think that that's necessarily a wrong question to ask your physician. The other is that if you are potentially dealing with, you know, a weight issue in addition to prediabetes, then in that situation, Wegovy may be covered for actual weight management. Now, this is, you know, insurance coverage for these conditions is a huge rate limiting step, as I'm sure Dr. Florence can relate to as well, because, you know, this is something that we really need to address as a nation, and insurance companies really need to get around, because if we don't fix the weight, we don't end up fixing the diabetes, we don't end up fixing blood pressure, cholesterol, heart disease. And so the coverage for these medications needs to change. And right now, some insurances will cover, you know, Wegovy, and we've got, you know, tirzepatide on the, you know, pipeline as well later this year for, you know, approval for weight management. So I think the push is coming for payers to start reimbursing or covering these medications, but we're not there yet, unfortunately.
Yeah. And if I could add, and I agree from an insurance standpoint, it's very frustrating. And when you think about the cost of the actual injection in the medicine, what we're losing sight on is the cost of heart disease, the cost of diabetes, and all those associated comorbid conditions with obesity, the need for joint replacements, sleep apnea. The cost to obesity is astounding to our healthcare system. So when you look at the cost of an injection such as this to manage that and reduce that overall lifetime cost, it really is a benefit for all of us, for these patients to get this medication they need.
I agree with that.
You know, Kathy O'Neill, we need to take a break in about a minute here, but what do you make of the, you know, the idea that insurance says, you know, well, maybe we're not going to cover this. A lot of insurers are still saying no, whereas, you know, people are still being expected to fork out billions of dollars for Weight Watchers and everything else along those lines.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll speak from my own experience. I've been a fat all my life, and I also have my family history of diabetes, and my father actually died from diabetes. So I was really, really interested in avoiding that. And I managed to get a bariatric surgery, which was considered a weight loss surgery, even though it's also extremely good at avoiding, keeping people from getting diabetes. And the number of hoops I had to go through, and I would argue not just hoops, but humiliating by construction hoops that I had to go through to get my insurance company to cover the bariatric surgery was astounding. And you have to understand that it's actually good for you, and it's actually good for your costs over your lifetime, as the doctor has just mentioned, to have the bariatric surgery, because you do avoid diabetes. You do typically lose a lot of weight. So it actually saves money in the long run. The problem with our insurance system is that it doesn't save money in the very short term. So they don't see the reason, right, that they should pay for long-term success. And so that's a kind of short-termism,
yeah,
problem we have in insurance.
I want to talk more about that when we come back. It strikes me as like a car company making you pay for seatbelts and airbags up front. Anyway, the 21st show. We're going to continue this conversation about Wegovy and Ozempic in this new category of weight loss drugs. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking all hour today about a drug originally used to treat diabetes. It's now being used to help people lose a significant amount of weight. But there are problems with this drug, particularly in the area of cost and accessibility. Leslie Stahl documented that in a report on CBS's 60 Minutes that aired in January.
It's not easy to get. The drug is currently in short supply, and it costs more than $1,300 a month. The vast majority of people with obesity simply can't afford Wegovy, and most insurance companies refuse to cover it, partly because, as AHIP, the Health Insurance Trade Association, explained in a statement, these drugs have not yet been proven to work well for long-term weight management and can have complications and adverse impacts on patients.
We're talking about all this with Dr. Disha Narang, Director of Obesity Medicine at Northwestern Medicine, Lake Forest Hospital, Dr. Nicole Florence, Medical Director and Bariatrician at Memorial Weight Loss and Wellness Center in Springfield, and Kathy O'Neill, who's a PhD mathematician and most recently author of the book The Shame Machine, Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also email us, talk@21stshow.org. Kathy, before the break, you were talking about your own experience with bariatric surgery, and you write about this in The Shame Machine. And I know this can be uncomfortable to talk about. I'm sure it was uncomfortable to write about, as you say in the book, so I appreciate you being willing to do so. But can you talk more about some of those hoops you had to jump through? I mean, your insurance company basically wanted a note from your doctor saying that you were incurable and, you know, like just a terrible human being is how it comes across in the book. You can talk about what that felt like.
Yeah, I had to like meet with my doctor once a month for 6 months, and get weighed every month. And at the end of the 6 months, the doctor had to write a letter saying that I tried multiple times in my life, and this time in particular, these 6 months, to lose weight the honest way. But I'd been a miserable failure. I'm irretrievably overweight, at a huge risk of illness, and like desperate for this surgery. And I had to have all that, like, you know, it was basically a part-time job. I also had to get a bunch of medical records that were very, very hard and very inaccessible. And I consider myself somebody who's extremely lucky to have been insured all my adult life. And considering that, I can't even imagine how people without as much good coverage could even qualify for this insurance. And of course, it is those very people that need to be insured. That need the surgery the most. Obesity is very correlated to class in this country. And I'll just add, by the way, that even after my surgery, and I had good care, I'm not complaining about my care, but even after my surgery, I was submitted to what I consider a humiliating series of meetings where they kept on asking me what my goal weight was, weighing me and sort of asking me why I haven't achieved my goal weight yet. And you know, if you don't mind, Brian, I'm going to bring it up as a philosophical thought experiment. Like, why do people think this is a choice? You know, especially in the light of Ozempic, where people sort of magically lose 60 pounds, like the first person we heard about on this hour, and then they gain it back afterwards. I mean, we know that just happens. People really don't have control over it. And so why, after a bariatric surgery where they essentially like tore out my stomach and tied up the rest with a twine, why would I suddenly go from not having control over my weight to having control over my weight? I still haven't figured out why they've done that to post-bariatric surgery patients, that they've given them the notion of a goal weight and then humiliated with them when they didn't achieve the goal weight. The whole thing seems to me like an exercise in shaming people, when in fact it's a systemic mystery that we have not solved.
You know, it puts me in mind, I was trying to think of this analogously as like the way we think about depression and mental health in our society. We don't tell people who have clinical depression, hey, watch Ted Lasso and, you know, stare at pictures of puppies for a little while, and you should just feel better. Just feel better. Come on, just work a little harder at feeling better. Dr. Florence, do you want to respond from Dr. Florence, Nicole Florence from Memorial Wellness Center in Springfield, please?
Well, first I want to say, Kathy, I am so sorry for that experience. We do perform bariatric surgery in our center. And you are correct. Having a quote unquote healthy BMI does not necessarily mean you're healthy. And I know a lot of unhealthy, skinny people. And so, you know, the goal should be, as you talked about, did I decrease my risk for heart disease, diabetes? Did I resolve my comorbid conditions? Am I in a place where I am more active and I'm making healthier choices? So I'm sorry that you had that experience, but I think when we look at where we are, even with these weight loss injections, there are people that maybe have the goal to reach the magic number at any cost or all costs, but they're not really looking at the individual and their true quality of life and their health status. It's kind of, you know, get to that number and that's the ideal. And that again goes to the shame of the industry.
Dr. Disha Narang, I want to pick up on something else that Kathy mentioned there, which is the idea of losing weight the honest way. I think that's the phrase she used. And there is this idea in American society that, you're going to use drugs. Oh, you're going to, you know, use surgery or something to lose weight. Whereas if only you'd exercise more, if only you could, you know, resist the temptation to eat that, you know, sugary food. Can you talk about that and what science tells us about that idea?
Yeah. And Kathy, again, I'm also so sorry that that was your experience. And, you know, being that I treat this as well, most patients do come in feeling shamed, and that's been kind of their whole life story. And that's the tragic part of all of this, right? That we have blamed this disease on willpower, and that's just not the case. And so what we're now seeing is that this is very much genetically mediated. A lot of these genetic insults can start to occur in utero, so before you're even born. And what can exacerbate it is our environment after we are born. And so, you know, a lot of obesity, overweight status often runs in families. And sure, you know, part of it could be someone's, you know, eating habits and that sort of thing, their demographic status, all of that. But that this can run in families genetically as well. And so for society to put this on willpower is absolutely a mistake. And what that has also led to then, again, is, you know, this shaming culture. It has led to a lot of mental health issues as well. So many of our patients who deal with overweight and obesity end up having long-term mental health issues around that as well. And you know, it's really created a pretty negative culture, a pretty toxic culture. And you know, that's what we're sort of trying to change at this stage.
So if we're moving from sort of thinking about obesity and weight as like a moral failure, almost in religious terms, it's discussed sometimes, and we're moving into sort of more medicalizing it and thinking of it as a diagnosis or a mental health problem, maybe even. How do these drugs that we've been talking about, how do they exactly work? Dr. Florence, maybe you can talk about that. What does semaglutide do to the body and the brain in particular?
Sure. I think, as I talked about before, there are so many hormones and chemicals that are at play. And our hunger, our fullness, and kind of our set point. And the way these injections work is in a way in your gut, and there's kind of this regulatory feedback system that goes to your brain and through to your stomach and hormones to say, hey, you've had enough. Let's slow it down. And telling your brain that you're not as hungry and you should be full. And as a result, you find that people are able to kind of have, I call it bumper rails, you know, like when you go bowling. And they're able to kind of stay in their true set point of their calorie intake. And so as they turn that off, so to speak, they are more successful at being able to, you know, choose those healthier choices and portions and exercise. Like Yolanda said, I felt better. I had more energy to exercise and do those things. And it's amazing for your patients to say, I look at food more as fuel. Instead of for comfort. And I think that's probably about the best way that I try to explain it. I don't know, Dr. Nering, if you have any more details or insight as well.
Yeah, you know, just kind of going back to the physiology, I think what has been interesting is that these medications, so obesity is a neurohormonal disease. It's very much mediated by our hormones that talk to our gut and talk to our brain. And so what the medications will do is suppress our hunger, increase our fullness feelings. And, you know, what I've noticed with patients, is one great analogy that a patient made was that, you know, previously I could eat, you know, four slices of pizza. Now I can maybe eat one and I'm pretty satisfied and I might eat a side salad with it. And so I think, you know, the food is fuel thing. It's really what I've found interesting is it's a mentality shift almost that people are experiencing on the medication, guided by their daily habits, right? And so sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. And we have non-responders as well, right? So it's not a magic wand at all. But I would say for a large number of people that shift about how you think about food really, really changes. And I think that's been fascinating.
Kathy, you write about this in the book. After your surgery, you developed a taste for Brussels sprouts. Can you talk about
it? Yeah. Thanks for coming back to me. Cause like, I will just say that it's kind of very tied in with this moralistic, you know, blame game going on. But like one of the things I noticed after my bariatric surgery is just how much my actual desires changed for what I wanted to eat. Like I had a sweet tooth beforehand. I don't anymore. Like I now like Brussels sprouts more than any other. I like bitter foods the most. It has nothing to do with my mindset, by the way. I do think it's like, just to be clear, I think it's the hormones, as you guys mentioned. I mean, by the way, as another aside, the kind of bariatric surgery I had, which is where they take out my stomach lining, it's called a sleeve surgery. It works pretty well to change your mindset, to lower your risk for diabetes and to lose weight. But the old fashioned way of doing it with lap band, which is where they just sort of squeezed your stomach really small, didn't work. And I think it's because they didn't take those metabolically active cells out of your stomach. It's really about the sort of those cells putting hormones into your body. But it's from the perspective of somebody who's gone through it, I didn't stop thinking about ice cream. Like, I mean, I just suddenly didn't want ice cream. Like, I really didn't want it. So it's like, just to be clear, not something that you have conscious control over. It is something that happens to you when you have the bariatric surgery, or I assume when you get Ozempic. And so it's not, you know, it often looks from the outside, from people's sort of judgmental space, that like, oh, you're eating so much better now. Like, good for you for making that choice. And I just want to really push and scrutinize that notion of choice. It's like, no, actually, this isn't a choice. This is what my body wants. And at the end of the day, we all do what our body wants.
Yeah, I heard you on another podcast, the Sleep Buddy podcast, talking about this. And the question came up, what even is free will when you think about the way these drugs and that surgery worked, right, Kathy?
Yeah, and Brian, thanks for it's like, I would hope, and this is just a philosophical hope, probably not going to be realized, that with the introduction of Ozempic, that we as a society stop thinking of weight as something that we have free will about. Like, it is just not up to us. It is up to our bodies. And like, I just also want to refer to an earlier comment that I think both of you guys mentioned, the doctors on the show, that it's genetically related, like people whose parents are overweight are typically overweight. That's true, of course. I'm not disagreeing with that. But it doesn't explain whatsoever why so many more Americans and, you know, people in the entire world, why is obesity growing so fast? We didn't suddenly lose willpower, if we put willpower aside, we didn't suddenly change our genetics in one generation to all have genetic predisposition to have to be fat. Like, but we are all getting fat. So there really is a scientific mystery here that has nothing to do with willpower. And I will finally add that, like, if we keep talking about willpower, we're missing the opportunity to do really interesting science.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Dr. Narang, we need to take a break in 2 minutes here, but I do want to ask, and I will say for our listeners, we will come to this, some of the questions about supply chains and things like that coming up later on. But I do want to ask about side effects and potential downsides of this drug. What do we know about potential side effects here? And maybe, I guess you have to say, in the context of the side effects of being overweight.
Right. Honestly, the side effects are overall minimal. These drugs are well tolerated for the most part. The most common reason that someone may stop the medication is due to stomach upset. So GI side effects typically would be a reason that someone may not want to take this long term. We do start at a low dose and go up very slowly so that tolerance can develop over time. And, you know, the other contraindications is that if you or a family member have a history of medullary thyroid cancer, so that's not papillary thyroid cancer, which is the majority of cases, but medullary, and multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, that's, you know, so that's a very rare condition, but that's why you wouldn't be able to take the medication. And then a history of pancreatitis would be another reason as to why someone wouldn't be eligible for the medication.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation after a break. We are talking all hour today about these drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, which are being used to help people control diabetes in one case and lose weight in the other. And also just the pressure and shame of weight in America. We're talking with Dr. Disha Narang, Director of Obesity Medicine at Northwestern Medicine, Lake Forest Hospital. Dr. Nicole Florence, Medical Director at Memorial Wellness Center in Springfield. And Kathy O'Neill, who's the author of The Shame Machine, Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. If you want to join our conversation today, 800-222-9455. Or you can reach out to us on Twitter at 21st Show, at 21st Show. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're spending all hour today talking about the weight loss and diabetes drugs known as semaglutide. Ozempic and Wegovy are the sort of marketing names for them. One is for Ozempic is approved for diabetes. Wegovy is for people with obesity and conditions like high blood pressure or high cholesterol. There was a clinical trial in 2021 that found that 15% on average decrease in body weight. But these drugs can cost $1,400 a month, and many insurance companies are not yet covering it. We're talking about this with Dr. Disha Narang, Director of Obesity Medicine at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital, Dr. Nicole Florence, Medical Director and Bariatrician at Memorial Wellness Center in Springfield, and Kathy O'Neill, who is a PhD mathematician and the author of the book The Shame Machine, Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. Dr. Florence, have you experienced any of this shortage, any of your patients coming in that we've been hearing about? You know, there's been these stories of celebrities, you know, taking advantage of this medication to, you know, look good for a role or something like that. I mean, how are you seeing this play out in the real world?
Well, we are definitely seeing that the patients that do qualify for this medication, their insurance pays for it. We are really having to scramble, especially on the type of medications we're prescribing, as the dosage that they need may not be available. There are adjustments that have to be made into their management where we might have to do a different dose that's available. So it's a little disheartening that the people who really need it can't get it. I know my nurses, there is a painful pre-authorization process that we have to go through to get patients the medicine they need. Most often they are denied. And it's a struggle for patients who really need it. And I don't think we've even begun the discussion on the disparities in healthcare of, you know, having a Medicaid patient who's pre-diabetic, obese, and has conditions. You know, Medicaid doesn't even pay for a dietitian, let alone weight loss medications. So we're seeing even our at-risk patients not being able to get what they need.
Dr. Narang, are you seeing that as well, a sort of economic class distinction in absolutely. Who can get the treatment for this? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've been dealing with this since early last summer, so this is not a new problem. Patients have not been able to get their medication. And I think there's also been a lot of inappropriate prescribing of the medication as well. So for patients who may not necessarily be eligible per guidelines. And, you know, the other issue is that we've seen unprecedented demand for the medications as well. And so this has precisely been, I think, because of social media, you know, celebrities and whatnot going viral because they're using these medications for short-term weight loss, you know, to get ready for an event or, you know, a special dress or whatever that might be. But I think that has taken off and really has been the fuel to create a lot of this shortage, right? Because people want a quick fix. People often want, you know, to fix something that, you know, it might be 5 pounds, it might be 10 pounds. However, that's not what the medication is intended for. And so I think we need to really understand, you know, that, hey, again, this is a chronic disease that needs long-term therapy. It's not a 3 week long medication that you take to get ready for something. And I think that has really created the issue of the short supply. The other is that, yes, you know, as Dr. Florence mentioned, for our patients who are really at high risk, like patients with poorly controlled diabetes, even severe obesity, they're not able to get that medication. And the folks who are affected most are the folks who don't necessarily have private insurance, if that private insurance even pays for or covers these medications. And so it's just become like a snowball effect, right? And with all of the inappropriate prescribing or overprescribing of the medication, all the other GLP-1 agonists for diabetes management are now also in short supply. So this has been a very interesting year, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Narang, you've talked about this briefly in the context, because we only got about 10 minutes left in our show today, but this is not a six-month plan. It's not a one-year plan or even a 5 years. What time horizon do people need to be thinking about?
If someone's been dealing with obesity for 40 years, this is not going to be a 6, 12, even 18-month treatment plan, right? This is a long-term therapy. And I want people to think about it as, you know, if we take off your cholesterol medication, your cholesterol numbers will go up. If we take off your blood pressure medication, your blood pressure will go up. If we take off your diabetes medication, your sugars will go up. This is the same thing. We take off your weight medication, your weight will go up. And so, you know, we need this on kind of longer term so that you have long-term suppression of some of these hormones that really drive appetite and really drive weight gain.
And so is this, Dr. Florence, this drug has only been approved for weight loss for what, a year or so now, maybe not even yet. I mean, is this something where what do we know what timeline it's safe and that people should be taking this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be ongoing studies, and the more we use it, the more information we are getting. I think it's really important to emphasize that people who know how to manage this medication, who understand how it works, who understand the chronic obesity management, are the ones that most likely need to be the ones doing this. So we can do that long-term follow-up. You know, the patients that I know I've had on this medication, you will, you know, like she said, we'll get their body mass index down, they'll feel great. And you may take a break from the medication and all of those symptoms resolve. So we are looking at it as this is going to be your long-term maintenance. Let's figure out what that is. And we're not necessarily looking at it as a six-month or a one-year treatment. But again, I think it's something that needs to be under the management of people who are fully versed at providers and teams that are fully versed at using this medication properly.
And sorry to interject, one thing I want to take from that as well is that there's a lot of clinics that are also now advertising compounded Ozempic and compounded Wegovy. Those are not approved by the FDA. We don't know what is being put into these substances. And a lot of these, you know, weight loss clinics are advertising this as a special cocktail to lose weight because people aren't able to get the original Wegovy or original Ozempic to lose weight. So there's a lot of clinics, I think, out there that are unfortunately, you know, really playing into people's vulnerability and desperation to lose weight. And so if you see compounded, we do not recommend taking that.
All right, I want to get a caller in. John is calling from Rockford on line 4. John, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. One thing I thought of is your guest mentioned something about it's really an opportunity to look at the science of why, you know, worldwide obesity is increasing, and that it's clearly not about willpower and more about biology. And an interesting element that I haven't heard come up, and maybe I missed it earlier, was, you know, we haven't really asked, like, what is our food doing to us? You know, of course it's genetic and or at least biological why people are becoming obese. It's not about willpower, but, you know, it's like, what is it about our food that is affecting our gut health or our gut itself or our bodies entirely, the hormones, you know? I read an article recently about Europe has banned 10,000 chemicals that are still in the food system in America. And we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to ourselves to make this happen? And it's probably way beyond just the genetics. Your other guest mentioned, she kind of said something about the idea of like, genetically like affected by things that have happened, you know, even in utero. And it's like, Yeah, I mean, your parents have been eating, you know, mechanized food, you know, industrial, like created food.
Yeah. All right, John. Thank you so much for that call. I really appreciate that. You know, Kathy, I want to ask you about this because you write in your book about this idea of fat shaming, but there's also this idea of exactly how much sugar is out there in the American diet now, and it's really can be quite challenging to avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, and the truth is, like, you know, it's easy enough to get carried away. By the way, I'm a mathematician. I do statistics. It's easy enough to get carried away by correlations between the amount of high fructose corn syrup that we take in versus the obesity. And who knows? I'm not saying I know. I'm saying that we actually don't know. And any particular theory isn't probably going to answer it. In particular, there's holes in almost every theory that we've come across so far. So I'm not going to answer that because I don't know. I just feel like it's not we're not having the right conversation about it. We're having a conversation that is based on personal shame and willpower. And I will just like to, if you don't mind, I'd like to make a provocative prediction. Sure. About the future of the near future of these weight loss drugs, which is, I know the doctors are both worried about their patients who really need these drugs for their diabetes and other reasons, but that, you know, the power of shame that we're actually grappling with, especially when you think about social media and the perfectionism and eating disorders and all that stuff is so much more palpable and immediate to people, not just celebrities, it's to like every single person on the earth right now. So I just don't think we don't have the brakes on this system that we would need in order to keep people from taking this. My prediction is that, you know, of course, the pharmaceutical companies are going to be able to figure out how to make these in much larger quantities in the near future. They're going to ramp up production just as they successfully ramped up production of COVID vaccines. And that's a good thing. But my prediction is that people are going to be taking this just as commonly as you see people have cell phones. Like it's going to be something that everyone has. And because nobody can resist that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it certainly there is that pressure out there. Dr. Florence, only about a minute left in our conversation today.
Yeah, just real quick, I appreciated John's statement. Actually, in our program, we have a full teaching kitchen. We have a culinary medicine program. We understand that it is important to change how we cook, to have less processed food. I know right now in our society, especially after COVID, it's been difficult. So our patients do get that teaching and education in a kitchen so that they can learn how to eat fresh produce, cook it, and make it taste good. And that's an integral part of taking these medications, is also learning all those lifestyle things that you can do along with the medication to treat your chronic illness.
Well, Dr. Florence, Dr. Narang, and Kathy O'Neill, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show for this conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, I am actually going to be on the road heading to a conference. We're going to be revisiting our conversation on the recent assault weapons ban in Illinois, as well as some of the legal maneuvering around that. We'll talk with advocates for the ban. We'll also hear from gun owners in Illinois about their perspective, and we'll hear from a legal expert on how those cases are likely to fare as they are playing out in the court system. That's coming up tomorrow on the 21st show. Then Thursday, a conversation with the Illinois-born, Illinois-educated novelist Will Leach. You may also know him as the founder of the sports website Deadspin. That's going to be Thursday on the 21st show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can get a podcast of this show on our website. If you like what you heard, you feel like somebody else might enjoy listening to it, please go ahead and share it. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Just search for The 21st. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.